You know, sometimes that's the best case. Sometimes they're just seen as people who are kids who just want to destroy public property and or sabotage the social order, who are not committed to studying. That's the way they're portrayed in the media. So the fact that this creates a narrative under which they can be attacked by impunity, whether it be the government, or whether it be the criminal organization. So this particular attack, I think, reflects the logical combination of the decades of criminalization of these schools and a situation in which the current Mexican government, it's really hard to tell where the state begins and where drug cartels end.
And the role of police?
The role of police here is very significant. Again, historically, when students mount any sort of social mobilization here to just demand simple things like food for these schools, an increase in scholarships, the protection of the infrastructure for these schools, they're instantly seen as criminals, and the police is then charged with attacking them. And in this last, or containing their mobilization, which often involves attacking them, in this particular mobilization, it's really significant to see that it was the police who first shot at them, the police who first detained these students and took them, and then it looks like handed them over to a criminal organization.
Do you believe the students are still alive?
It's very hard to tell. Honestly, the fact that the DNA showed that they were not those in this mass grave, to a certain extent, gives us hope. On the other hand, just the sheer amount of days that have now passed and that turning up, to me, points to a bit of a tragic end. Not to mention, just in the whole context of this is what, unfortunately, is now becoming the norm in Mexico, mass graves, assassinations. For a long time, political analysts have warned that the militarization of the drug war has been targeting social activists, not just the drug cartels. And I think this becomes
very explicit. Conalise Padilla, we have to leave it there. I'm sorry to say. Associate Professor of Latin American History at Dartmouth, speaking to us from London. We'll certainly continue to cover this. And Valeria Hamel, human rights activist, law student in Mexico City. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. Up next, the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Cross Cultural Rhythms at the 40th Avenue Garage, a showcase of music, dance, and spoken word performances, all sharing roots in African culture. Cross Cultural Rhythms will take place on Saturday, October 18th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the 40th Avenue Garage, 1711 Southeast 40th Avenue in Portland. This is a benefit for the Obo Addy Legacy Project. Confirmed performances include Ghanaian drumming and dance, South African boot dance and music, multiple spoken word artists, and more. Again, that's Cross Cultural Rhythms, Saturday, October 18th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the 40th Avenue Garage in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor $15 Now, a community hearing on the City of Portland's fair wage policy. This hearing will happen Monday, October 20th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the SEIU Union Hall at 3536 Southeast 26th Avenue in Portland. Portland's fair wage policy was adopted by the city in 1995 and is currently $10.38 an hour plus benefits. The community hearing will have testimony from workers, and Portland City Commissioners will be present and will be invited to respond to the workers' testimony. Again, that's $15 Now, a community hearing on the City of Portland's fair wage policy. Monday, October 20th, 7 p.m. at the SEIU Union Hall, 3536 Southeast 26th Avenue in Portland. More information about this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm Monica Beamer.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. We're KBOO's new co-station managers. We're excited to be a part of the KBOO community. We're starting a new weekly feature on Wednesdays at 5:45 p.m., News from the Boo will give you an inside look into what's happening at KBOO including upcoming events, station news, special programming, and future goals and plans for the station.
Be sure to tune in this Wednesday and every Wednesday after the KBOO Evening News for News from the Boo, an insider look into your community radio station.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Community College, where the Southeast Center at 82nd and Division is now a full-fledged campus, allowing students to earn an associate's degree in their own neighborhood. PCC celebrates on October 18th at noon with campus tours, local food vendors, and live Afro-Cuban music by Maleo de Cuba. pcc.edu/celebrate.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a second healthcare worker has been diagnosed with Ebola in Texas.
Governor John Kitzhaber answers questions about First Lady Sylvia Hayes at last night's gubernatorial debate.
And we take a look at a new pesticide approved by the EPA.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 15th, 2014. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. The Oregon Republican Party is reportedly filing an ethics complaint against Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber and First Lady Sylvia Hayes. The state Republican Vice Chair, Bill Currier, said yesterday the complaint will center on Hayes' fees for speaking engagements and charges that Kitzhaber was complicit in relaxing rules regarding his fiancée's role as a paid consultant. Kitzhaber himself has asked the commission to examine Hayes' work in the governor's office. A story by Willamette Week last week questioned Hayes' influence on the governor and the obscured lines between her public and private roles when billed at speaking engagements. She endured further controversy last week when it was revealed that she was paid $5,000 to enter into a green card marriage with an Ethiopian immigrant in 1997. Further accusations were made yesterday by a former landlord that she rented a cabin in Washington in order to operate a marijuana grow site that same year. At a gubernatorial debate last night between Kitzhaber and challenger Representative Dennis Richardson, Kitzhaber addressed the allegations.
Well, let me say that I have received a lot of new information over the last week. Some of it's been very hard to assimilate. What we know is that 17 years ago, before I knew Sylvia and she knew me, she was involved in some illegal activities. I don't condone it. I wish it hadn't happened, but it did. She's acknowledged it, which took some courage, and she's assumed responsibility for it and is willing to face the consequences. The fallout of that set of activities and how we deal with that fallout is really a personal matter between Sylvia and myself.
Representative Richardson then responded.
I think it's very interesting that, you know, we shouldn't be focusing really on what happened 17 years ago, because that's between Sylvia Hayes and the law enforcement. But it's a character issue, and it plays in what's happening presently. And we have a governor who had an ethical letter from his chief of staff and his chief legal advisor, and it didn't seem to fit with what Sylvia Hayes wanted, and so it was rewritten. And so my question is, Governor, did you know that the ethics advice that you were given was that she was violating her ethical responsibilities by using Mahonia Hall and by using staff and by using her title? And then was it your direction that actually told your staff to change the ethical opinion so that it would allow her to continue to do those things?
Would you like to respond?
Yeah, actually, as I said, when she came into office, we have this obvious issue of the First Lady and some of the professional career, and we set up procedures and processes and a legal review process. And it was multi-layered, and we worked very, very hard and diligently to make sure that her activities fell within the spirit and the intent and the letter of Oregon ethics laws, and I believe that they did and do.
That was Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber and opponent Dennis Richardson debating last night in Portland. Kitzhaber is enjoying a 20-point lead over his opponent in the most recent polls.
Markham Elementary School in southwest Portland was put on lockdown today when Portland police responded to the scene of a nearby explosion. The explosion was reported around 12:30 today at a nearby townhouse. Police told a secretary at Markham that the explosion took place inside a vehicle. Residents of the Terry Lee Manor townhouse complex said that two cars had been damaged in the back lot of the building, where black smoke was coming from underneath one and the back window of another had been shattered. Police and fire units dispatched to the scene were investigating nearby cars, including cars at Markham. The explosives disposal unit was also on the scene. No students were injured in the blast, and the school reported that all students were accounted for and safe. The police have not yet said what caused the blast.
At the Portland City Council meeting today, city commissioners approved a 10% tax on marijuana sales in the city of Portland. The tax will go into effect if voters decide to legalize marijuana in the state this November. It will apply to any marijuana businesses in the city of Portland and will include taxes on the sale, transfer, mixing, handling, or serving of any marijuana product. The revenues will go to offset increased costs to the city of Portland in connection with the legalization of marijuana, including funding law enforcement and other services. The city's Department of Revenue estimates that the tax will bring in between $1.5 million and $4 million a year. Also at today's city council meeting, the council approved a permit for a new multi-housing complex at Powell Boulevard and Cesar Chavez Boulevard, despite some concerns about parking. The developers of the site contradicted himself during his testimony, initially saying that he is committed to providing parking for the residents of the new building. But when Amanda Friss raised the possibility of including that as a requirement in the permit, he said that he would like to leave his options open on whether or not to provide parking.
So I see in the report that you're planning to provide 18 parking spaces, but there's no condition of approval for that. And my understanding is you're not required to provide any parking.
Correct.
So that's of concern, seeing the aerial photographs of Franklin Street already being parked up. The comprehensive plan talks about preserving on-street parking for the benefit of the commercial areas. So where do you think your residents are going to park their cars?
So we're planning on one parking unit for every unit that we provide. So we are planning on-site parking. And again, this kind of gets to the long-term ownership perspective. If we were turning around and selling the property, we might not be concerned about providing parking, but we want this to be a viable project for the long term. We think that providing parking is an important component to attracting residents and providing them with the proper amenities to live in that portion of Portland.
So you would accept a condition of approval requiring one parking spot per unit?
I think we would have to consider that. Again, we have kind of a whole team working on this that includes designers. And one of the important things that I think we would like to preserve is the flexibility to manipulate the design. So as we look at balancing landscape and building form and parking, we might find, for example, that it would make sense to eliminate or add a parking space.
So then why did you object to the condition requiring design review?
Design review adds time and cost and uncertainty, which all provides kind of risk and potential cost to a development. It can ultimately lead to higher costs in development. It could mean higher rents that need to be charged for units, less affordability. And so under the current zoning, there are requirements on height and building setbacks, which when matched with an excellent and capable architecture firm results in good design, in my opinion. So for that reason, we're wanting the more streamlined path and the ability to work directly with the architect on the design development of the project.
The issue of the new multi-housing buildings without parking has been a major issue in inner southeast Portland in recent years, along with increased rents and gentrification of the neighborhoods.
A former Sunset High School student accused of sexually assaulting and murdering a classmate in 1990 is due to be released tomorrow. Conrad Angweiler was convicted of aggravated murder, rape, and sodomy in 1991 for an attack on classmate Aaron Reynolds. Angweiler was 15 and Reynolds was 16 at the time of the attack. Angweiler was initially given a life sentence with a 30-year minimum. His sentence has been litigated throughout his incarceration as the state struggled with sentences handed to five juvenile offenders convicted of aggravated murder between 1989 and 1995. In 2011, the Oregon Supreme Court ordered Angweiler to be given a release date after it found that a harsher sentence handed down to him in 1994 was unconstitutional. The court ruled that Angweiler was entitled to time off for good behavior while in prison last December. Angweiler will be under supervision of parole authorities in Deschutes County, will have to register as a sex offender, and is barred from contact with his victim's family.
A new report in the Portland Mercury has found a planned propane terminal along the Columbia River in Portland may actually violate the city's zoning code. Reporter Dennis Sirot found that the project, as currently envisioned, runs afoul of the city's zoning code, specifically the city's rules for safeguarding sensitive wildlife along the Columbia. And unless Portland City Council is willing to slightly tweak those rules at a hearing as soon as next spring, the project would be impossible to build. The $500 million project was heavily promoted at Portland's business leaders and praised by Mayor Charlie Hales as a way to provide jobs. But environmental groups say they were never consulted and the project has slipped through without an environmental assessment. Now the company needs to backtrack and apply for zoning variances, and those will be hard to get approved. The Port of Portland has called the proposed propane terminal, pitched by Canadian firm Pembina, one of the largest single private capital investments in the city's history. But because the site involves a thin strip of riverfront protected by some of the city's strongest conservation rules, the transportation of hazardous materials like propane is not allowed on that location unless it's done by rail or motor vehicle. This means the planned gas pipeline would not be able to go to the terminal. And the attempt to change the city code would likely apply to the rest of the Port of Portland's Terminal 6. This means it would set the stage for liquefied natural gas pipelines into the Port of Portland along the Columbia River. The company is working on details at the time as the city is pushing through its code change. Pembina has said it hopes to have the terminal open by 2018.
A former New York mayor has joined a growing list of wealthy out-of-state donors trying to convince Oregonians to vote for Measure 90. Mayor Michael Bloomberg has donated $1.25 million to the campaign for Measure 90, a ballot initiative that would create a top-two primary in Oregon. Mayor Bloomberg joins Texas billionaire John Arnold and other wealthy non-Oregonian business leaders who have supported the bill. Under Measure 90, the two candidates who received the most votes in a primary would advance to the general election, even if they were part of the same party. Opponents of the measure argue that Measure 90 would allow business interests to have more control of elections. They also say it would create a spoiler effect, where candidates from a less popular party could get elected because there are more candidates on the other side. In 2012 in California, for example, a similar voting system caused Republicans to win in a mostly Democratic district. Oregonians overwhelmingly defeated a similar measure, Measure 65, in 2008.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the VU, followed by Occupy Portland Radio at 6. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy in the morning, but clear in the afternoon with a high of 70 and a low of 54. Today in history, in 1582, Pope Gregory XIII implemented the Gregorian calendar. This meant that October 15th was preceded by October 4th that year. In 1793, during the French Revolution, French Queen Marie Antoinette was tried in Paris and condemned to death the very next day. In 1965, in Manhattan, the Catholic worker movement burned the first draft card in protest of the Vietnam War, and in 1966, today marked the founding of the Black Panther Party in Oakland. Our quote of the day is from Black Panther Party co-founder Huey P. Newton. You can jail a revolutionary, but you can't jail the revolution.
It's 519, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Gabillionaires who invest in hedge funds generally have the ethical and aesthetic sensibilities of dirt clods. As far as they care, fund managers can put their money into skunk pelt futures as long as the investment pays a super fat return. But since Wall Street's 2008 crash revealed that so many of these investment schemes were based on nothing more than financial cobwebs and fairy dust, some of the clods began seeking hedge funds that would invest in something more down to earth. Thus, Wall Street discovered dirt, more specifically, farmland. Such money handlers as BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, now offer big pieces of America's heartland as an asset that super-rich penthouse dwellers can own and till for mega profits. As a result, ag professors report that their Farm Belt conferences on land economics, which normally draw an audience of farmers and local farm lenders, are dominated these days by Wall Streeters, and American farmland investment seminars are even being held in Dubai and Singapore. But this Wall Street land rush is a flimsy fad, for it's not based on economic realities. While crop prices are at record highs today, the painful historic record is that they will plummet tomorrow, destroying the cash flow that makes the hedge fund investment in land work. Then, of course, the gabillionaires will rush to shed their overalls. But who will line up to buy the land? Certainly not real farmers who can't afford the inflated Wall Street price, and especially not young people who want to farm but are already finding it hard to locate affordable land. This is Jim Hightower saying America desperately needs this next generation of food producers. Yet we're letting Wall Street speculators literally wall off the land they need. To learn more, contact the National Young Farmers Coalition at youngfarmers.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A second healthcare worker who treated a Liberian man diagnosed with the Ebola virus in Dallas has now tested positive for the disease. Officials at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital have declined to release the infected worker's name, disclose what position she holds, or what care she administered to Thomas Eric Duncan, a Liberian man who died of the virus last week. The news comes as workers at the hospital have reported insufficient precaution and shoddy infection control equipment at the hospital. Also revealed is that the worker traveled on a Frontier Airlines flight from Cleveland to Dallas-Fort Worth on Monday. U.S. health officials are attempting to contact the passengers on that flight. However, the healthcare worker was not showing symptoms during the flight. Ebola can only be contracted by physical contact with the bodily fluids of those who are showing symptoms. Texas Health Presbyterian nurse Nina Pham was the first healthcare worker to contract the virus in the U.S. She and 48 others who had contact with Duncan are being monitored in isolation as a precaution. The World Health Organization said today that they expect as many as 10,000 new cases of Ebola each month in the Western African states where the epidemic has killed 4,000 people since March. The WHO also said they expect a mortality rate of 70% in African victims, up from 50% so far.
The controversial head of Mars Hill Church is stepping down. Mark Driscoll, the founder of the megachurch, had been accused of bullying, financial mismanagement, and plagiarism in his sermons. Driscoll had been credited with modernizing evangelicalism in the U.S. Mars Hill has 15 churches in 5 states and a congregation of 14,000. In a statement, Driscoll said, quote, "I readily acknowledge I am an imperfect messenger of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Specifically, I have confessed to past pride, anger, and a domineering spirit." Mars Hill has been criticized for its dogma concerning strict and rigid interpretations of gender roles congregants were instructed to adhere to, and for its hostility toward gays and lesbians. Driscoll once criticized depictions of Jesus that he found emasculating, saying he had trouble worshiping, quote, "a gay hippie in a dress," end quote. In 2007, Driscoll attempted to reduce the powers held by church elders after they bought an ad in the New York Times accusing him of abuse. 9 of those elders were either later fired or left the church. His resignation comes after he announced a leave of absence in August.
Today, the Environmental Protection Agency approved a harmful pesticide called Enlist Duo. Enlist Duo will pose an immediate threat to endangered species, especially the monarch butterfly, which has already been devastated by widespread pesticide use. The EPA has also acknowledged that one of the chemicals used in the new product is dangerous to aquatic species. Yet none of this has stopped the approval process. Eric Tegetthoff of KBOO News spoke with Brett Hartle, Endangered Species Policy Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, to find out why this pesticide was approved by the EPA.
Today we're talking about the EPA's decision to approve a new pesticide called Enlist Duo, and I was wondering if you could explain to us a little bit what that pesticide is.
Sure. So Enlist Duo is a combination of glyphosate, which is more commonly known as Roundup, and a pesticide called 2,4-D. They're both herbicides, and this new pesticide is specifically tailored for genetically modified corn and soybeans. So it's a combination pesticide that basically kills every other plant on the field except things that are genetically modified tolerate it.
And so on what grounds did the EPA approve of this new pesticide?
So EPA is required under what's called the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act to review pesticides and new pesticide products like Enlist Duo, and they have to make a finding about whether or not they, present a significant risk to the environment. As part of that inquiry, however, they are also supposed to consult on the effects of on endangered species, and in this case, they did not do that. So they're required to assess the impacts under the law called FIFRA, but they fail to look at the endangered species under the Endangered Species Act.
And why do you think that is?
Well, so in this situation, this pesticide is going to be used on a pretty large scale, and it's pretty important to major pesticide companies. Doing a consultation is very difficult. The EPA has refused in the past to consult on the effects of endangered species, and this has been a problem for almost 20 years, so it's not unique to this situation. It's just very unfortunate because the effects of glyphosate and 2,4-D are quite pronounced. Between these two chemicals, in the most recent years, they're using over 300 million pounds total, 250 million pounds of glyphosate, 30 or 40 million pounds of 2,4-D. That's a lot of chemicals to be putting in the environment without looking at the effects on endangered species.
And they also did not consultate the Fish and Wildlife Service, which they are required to do. Do they have a history of doing this in the past?
Yeah, so the EPA has really chronically failed to look at the effects on endangered species, and they've failed to consult with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service because, they probably wouldn't like the answers that they got. The Fish and Wildlife Service are our nation's expert wildlife biologists, and they're really the ones that are best equipped to look at the impacts of pesticides on endangered species. But if you want to avoid putting on additional restrictions on pesticide use, then the easy way to do it is just to avoid talking to the experts and hope no one notices.
Has the Fish and Wildlife Service made any objections to being sidestepped by the EPA?
Well, they're under the Endangered Species Act, the Fish and Wildlife Service can't force the EPA to follow the law. So groups like mine, the Center for Biological Diversity, bring lawsuits to try to ensure that the EPA does follow the law. The Fish and Wildlife Service can't make them, so I don't want to speak to whether or not they like it or not, but they're sort of powerless to stop EPA from breaking the law.
And so maybe in a more perfect world, would the best solution be to make sure that the Fish and Wildlife is consulted in matters like these?
Well, sure. The law is very clear. They are supposed to consult with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service whenever endangered species may be affected by the use of pesticides. So that, forget about a perfect world. That would just be complying with the law. And in this situation, the EPA did not do that.
How long did it take the EPA to review this pesticide and approve it?
Right. So the EPA received an application to approve Enlist Duo just over 2 years ago. So it took them 28 months or so. In contrast, we've been waiting over 10 years to have the Fish and Wild, or have the EPA consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service on the effects of 2,4-D on endangered species, and the pesticide glyphosate hasn't had an endangered species assessment ever, and it's been over 20 years since the last time EPA even looked at it. So, you know, the EPA clearly has the priority of approving pesticides for use, but they are not looking at the impacts on endangered species.
That was Brett Hartle of the Center for Biological Diversity. I'm Eric Tegedoff of KBOO News.
The Center for Media and Democracy released a report today outlining numerous conflicts of interest by the governors of U.S. states. In one of the most explosive findings, the center revealed shocking new allegations of a murder-for-hire plot in Michigan in connection with that state's failed outsourcing of prison services. In 2013, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder invited the Philadelphia-based for-profit company Aramark to take over food services in the state's prisons. The action was a 180-degree change in course, as the administration previously rejected all such bids on the grounds that none of the proposals would save the state money. The $500,000 that Aramark spent on lobbying may have contributed to the change in policy. Since Aramark took over Michigan's food service contract, one scandal has followed another. The state fined Aramark nearly $100,000 in March for food shortages, unauthorized menu substitutions, and sexual relations between kitchen workers and inmates. The company was fined another $200,000 in August after the problems were not addressed. Throughout this period, Michigan's governor has stood behind the company, and the state's director of prison secretly waived the fine soon after it was imposed. But now the company is facing new allegations that an Aramark worker asked a prisoner to assist him with the murder of another inmate. The Center for Media and Democracy points out that Aramark's failed outsourcing of prison food services is a dramatic example of the harms that can arise from outsourcing America's public services and assets. In their report today on how governors facilitate the predatory outsourcing of America's public services, the center outlines many other cases of outsourcing that ended up with higher costs, lawsuits, and scorching headlines. The researchers found that all too often, taxpayers are the losers when transparency, accountability, and the public interest are sold out to for-profit firms.
The Arkansas Supreme Court has struck down the state's voter ID law. The court sided with a lower court's ruling, finding that the requirement was an imposed barrier to voting by the state. The court cited the state constitution, which requires citizens be both citizens of the U.S. and Arkansas, 18 years old, and registered to vote. 31 states have an ID requirement before voters can cast a ballot. 7 other states have photo ID laws. A federal court restored Texas's voter ID law yesterday. Judges concluded that dropping the requirement in Texas would cause confusion, but did not rule on whether the requirement should stand past the upcoming election.
Twitter has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. government seeking to be allowed to report on the number of secret surveillance requests filed by the U.S. government. Currently, the tech company is not allowed to provide any information about secret government requests for information about its users. The government can make secret requests for user data, including national security, using national security letters or the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Twitter is barred even from revealing the number of requests it receives for user data, even if that number is zero. The company has stated that they believe their users deserved a greater level of transparency and that it was their First Amendment right to report on the scope of government spying. So far, the Justice Department has prohibited Twitter from publishing even a censored version of the report on government surveillance in their transparency report.
University students in Mexico City have called for 2 days of protest in solidarity with the 43 missing students in the state of Guerrero. The students disappeared on September 26th after protests in which 3 other students were killed by police. A local gang leader said the police ordered him to kill 17 of the student protesters after they were rounded up. Students were protesting educational reform that would add tuition fees and essentially, as student Sylvia Caballero claimed to Al Jazeera, make universities more for the elite than for the public. The teacher training colleges where the students were studying is known for catering to the poor and the indigenous populations. Since the students went missing, mass graves have been found in the area. However, none of the bodies found in those graves have been identified as belonging to the 43 missing students. Across Mexico, students are demanding to know the location or fate of the missing students. A week ago, the missing students' classmates vowed radical action if they were not returned alive. Yesterday's protesters set fire to government buildings in Chilpancingo, capital of the state of Guerrero.
The Canadian National Energy Board has delayed a planned oil pipeline from Canada through the United States. The proposed Enbridge oil pipeline is almost as extensive as the controversial Keystone XL pipeline, but it has garnered fewer news headlines. Until now, the project had been moving forward quietly without much public debate. But recent civil disobedience by Native and environmental activists has brought a renewed focus to the Enbridge pipeline. Now the Canadian government says that energy company Enbridge will have to take more safety measures to protect major waterways before it gets permission to start up its oil pipeline. The order from the National Energy Board this week will delay plans to start up the pipeline project by at least 3 months and possibly longer. It may force the company to do even more work to bring its pipeline up to standards before the oil flows. Enbridge has applied to the board for the final steps in its pipeline process and was planning to open the pipeline in November.
During a visit to the Gaza Strip on Tuesday, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon voiced hope that the Palestinians and Israelis will resume peace negotiations soon. Meanwhile, in a conference in Cairo on Sunday, representatives of more than 30 countries pledged billions of dollars in financial support to rebuild the war-torn Gaza Strip coastal enclave. In Gaza, the UN is still housing about 50,000 people who were displaced during 7 weeks of violence this summer, while thousands of residential buildings await reconstruction. Among the displaced, hundreds of families are sheltering in temporary metal sheds placed in their communities. FSRN's Rami Almangari visited one of the devastated neighborhoods of Gaza and has this story.
About 10 feet away from their battered neighborhood in the Khuza'a rural town in southern Gaza, a total of 26 households of the extended Al-Najjar family now live in temporary shelters made of corrugated metal. Nida Al-Najjar lives in one of the metal box shelters with her husband and the three children.
Before, I used to finish all my errands at this time of the day, but now I am always cleaning this place. Water runs out from under the kitchen sink and inside the bathroom itself. As for the two rooms, they are good. Before, we were living, but we were living better. And we do appeal to all concerned to find a solution to our current situation.
Al-Najjar's metal shelter, along with the many others in the area, was donated by the United Arab Emirates Charitable Works Society. A local official in Khuza'a told Afasaran that the number of metal shelters will soon increase to 100. Each shelter is just over 100 square feet in size and can accommodate up to 6 people. Shehda Abu Rok is the mayor of Khuza'a. He says that with no equipment or building materials, workers in his jurisdiction are unable to rebuild.
I am very concerned that the temporary shelters will remain and become an alternative to reconstruction. If this happens, we will never accept them as an alternative to reconstruction. Also, I hold Dr. Rami Alhamdallah, the Palestinian Prime Minister, responsible for rebuilding because I have no equipment and there's none in the municipality.
The Israeli military offensive during the summer completely destroyed 450 homes in Khuza'a alone, displacing around 2,500 local residents. A few hundred of them are among tens of thousands still taking shelter in UNRWA-run schools in nearby areas. Last month, Israel agreed to allow raw building materials and logistic supplies into the Gaza Strip under the supervision of UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees. On Tuesday, the first shipment of construction supplies, including an estimated 600 tons of cement, 50 truckloads of gravel, and 10 truckloads of steel, finally entered the devastated region. Also Tuesday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon visited the region and saw the devastation firsthand.
The destruction which I have seen while coming to here is beyond the description. This is a much more serious destruction than what I saw in 2009, immediately after the violence at the time. The international community has shown a strong solidarity and support for the people of Palestine, particularly for the reconstruction of Gaza by mobilizing $5.4 billion.
The 2009 violence that the Secretary General referred to was another Israeli military action against Gaza, during which some 1,400 Palestinians and 13 Israelis died. This summer, Israel again launched a major offensive on the entire Gaza Strip, killing at least 2,100 Palestinian men, women and children, wounding about 10,000 others and internally displacing tens of thousands of people. 70 Israelis, most soldiers, died. The war also left much of Gaza's infrastructure either partially or completely destroyed. The 1.1 million inhabitants of the region still suffer from power outages of 12 hours each day, and access to potable water remains limited. While construction materials did begin to cross the border Tuesday, it remains unclear if shipments will freely continue or if they will flow at a rate sufficient to adequately rebuild. Rami Almirari, Afos Aran, Gaza.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, eight people were killed today after insurgents detonated a car bomb during an army operation in the Eastern Coast province. The soldiers were storming the hideout of suspects they believed to be potential suicide bombers. A car bomb in the compound detonated after the soldiers had gained control of it. Five Afghan soldiers were wounded in the explosion. Afghan officials say that they have captured two senior leaders of the insurgent Haqqani network in the operation. In other news, in Helmand province, gunmen ambushed a local leader and his bodyguard, killing them both. No one claimed responsibility for the attack.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. National Nurses United's Roseanne DeMauro says what happened in Dallas can happen anywhere in the U.S. She says nurses have been ignored and lied to as they press for better Ebola preparedness, and her union is calling on President Obama to order mandatory uniform national Ebola protocols.
We've been told a lot of things that have been wrong. We've been lied to in terms of the preparation in the hospitals. What happened in Dallas could happen anywhere. We've been essentially ignored by the White House and by the CDC, and they've been giving the hospital far too much credit in terms of assuming that they would actually take their advice. The only way to adequately confront the Ebola crisis that the World Health Organization has termed the most significant health care crisis in modern history is for the president to invoke his executive authority to mandate uniform national standards and protocols that all hospitals must follow.
National Nurses United President Deborah Berger says no Ebola protocols were in place or practiced in Dallas, and nurses around the nation are reporting similar situations.
The nurses state that they have been given no policies or regulations. There was no one to pick up hazardous waste as it piled to the ceiling. They did not have access to proper supplies and did observe the Infection Control Department and the CDC themselves violate basic principles of infection control, including cross-contaminating between patients. The nurses strongly feel unsupported, unprepared, lied to, and deserted to handle the situation on their own.
The Nurses Union says in Liberia and in Sierra Leone, health systems are overwhelmed and underfunding of public health systems worldwide is a critical problem. Rebecca Milner is on the West Africa Ebola front lines working with International Medical Corps.
It's an unprecedented emergency for us and the international community in general. Conditions in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea continue to deteriorate. The number of cases in both Liberia and Sierra Leone are increasing week over week, and there is no evidence at this time that the epidemic in West Africa is being brought under control. In Liberia, Ebola is called nurse killer because so many Liberian nurses have died while treating Ebola victims.
Dr. Lisa Berceau of the University of Illinois says that aerosol transmission of Ebola is a strong possibility, and she blames the CDC for not doing enough to protect healthcare workers.
The most important reason for this failure in preparation and in proper risk assessment can be placed directly at the doorstep of CDC. CDC has failed to consult with the federal agencies that focus on worker health and safety.
Workers Rutgers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Eric Tegadoff and David Lessem. The producer is Mike Klepfer. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Dave Mazza guest hosts Voices from the Edge Talk Radio, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9 o'clock, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, host Per Fogering speaks with writer and professor Andrew Basevich on President Obama's strategy against the so-called Islamic State. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, we speak with journalist and author Alex Christie about her new book, Gutenberg's Apprentice, a novel based on the story of Gutenberg and his apprentice and the production of the Gutenberg Bible. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support in our recent membership drive. We really appreciate your contributions.
KBOO News from the Boo with
Mike
and
Monica Beamer.
Yes, it is Wednesday at about 5:45, and it is once again time then for News from the Boo, our weekly roundup of news from inside the station and the surrounding community. We have with us tonight one of our co-station managers, Mike Crenshaw. Mike, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How's it going, Brian?
Not too bad. Good. So, as we just mentioned a moment ago, the membership drive has wrapped up. Things look to have gone successfully. Can you give us information on how the membership drive went?
Yeah, we ended our drive a day early, and we reached our goal of $80,000 in just under 11 days. The vibe was great around here. People had a lot of positive energy, so I want to thank all our new members, our renewing members, and our volunteers and staff for helping our drive go smoothly and successfully, and, of course, all the restaurants that supported us with food.
Fantastic. Can you talk a little bit about some of the events KBOO is sponsoring these days?
Yeah, coming right up right now, this weekend, as a matter of fact, this Saturday, we have the Obo Addy Legacy Project event. There's a benefit going on at the 40th Avenue Garage, which is actually a venue at a board member's house, board member of the Obo Addy Legacy Project. For those of you that don't know, Obo Addy formed the Obo Addy Legacy Project here in Portland to do outreach in schools and educational institutions and universities and introduce the music of Ghana and Ga culture and the drumming and dancing to young audiences, and to also teach people the art and culture of Ga and Ghana. And we're having a benefit show this Saturday. It'll go from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. There will be Okoprong, LaRonda Still and her family, Spoken Word with Taria Autry, Black Butterfly, myself, Zingwana, and Eben's Band. So again, that's 1711 Southeast 40th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, from 7 to 10 this Saturday.
What else do we have going on?
Many people knew, Derek Reith, who was a percussionist who tragically passed away August 20th, 2014. He was one of the founding members of Pink Martini and also went on to form many other projects like Go Green Go Go and others in the Portland area over the years. And since he passed away, there's a Sunday, October 19th benefit concert for him at the Conga Club, 4923 Northeast MLK Boulevard. So if you knew Derek or you were a supporter of his music, the money from that benefit is going to go to his foundation that introduces the musical and percussion traditions from Cuba, Brazil, and the African diaspora to youth. So that again is Sunday, October 19th, 2014 at the Conga Club, 4923 North MLK Boulevard, 7 p.m. to midnight.
Great. Well, KBOO is a local station, but we also like to think globally. So can you talk a little bit about what we have going on in the Global Affairs Department?
I am. I've been talking about this a lot because I'm excited and I want as many people that can find out about it to know about it. KBOO is co-sponsoring the African Hip Hop Caravan this year. I'll be leaving November 5th. The caravan kicks off on the 7th of November in Cape Town, South Africa, and we'll be going on to do a number of cities. There's also an installment of the caravan that's actually happening on the 7th of November, earlier than the Cape Town engagement in Togo. I won't be there. So again, I'll be in Cape Town from the 7th of November through, I think, about the 12th. And then we're going on to Harare, Zimbabwe, and then Arusha, Tanzania after that, and then Nairobi, Kenya. And I've never been to Arusha, Tanzania, and I've never been to Kenya. So I'm excited about that. I'll be bringing back plenty of material to share with KBOO listeners in December.
And there have been some articles published in the Journal of Hip Hop Studies about the caravan. Are you seeing more attention for this event as it goes on?
Yeah, actually, we've got KBOO is co-sponsoring a social media campaign to raise awareness and support through crowdfunding for the caravan. So you might be seeing some tweets about the caravan. And if you go to the KBOO website page, KBOO.fm, in the weeks and months to come, you'll be seeing information about the caravan. And then more can be found out at hiphopcaravan.net.
You know, on a related matter, there is an upcoming show from Roger Pete concerning his relationship with the Democratic Republic of Congo. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, that's going to be an opening that starts, gosh, what is that? Is it the 4th? Oh, man, I don't want to misquote it. It's going to basically be the first Thursday at PNCA is going to be the opening. And Roger is going to have a number of installments in an exhibit that focuses on traps, flows, and echoes, and focuses on the idea of a trap in a number of different contexts that relate to Roger and his life experience. One of the contexts is his time he spent in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where he worked for several seasons to promote community conversation through art. And some of the work will showcase some of the mask making and puppet making that he did there, as well as him and I have collaborated on a project that involves some of the music from the Obanga village that was really deep in the interior of the Congo. And it was a village that was particularly vulnerable to poaching. And it's interesting now because he's been working on this project for years. And right now we have the Ebola crisis in Western Africa. And It's actually eating some of the bush meat that has been blamed for the outbreak of Ebola and the spread of Ebola in different populations in Africa. But Roger spent some time in this village that was really deep in the interior, and the only people who actually went in the village besides the people that lived there were either soldiers or poachers who were after some of the endemic species that live really deep in the interior. And he was actually recruited to try to help start and support this conservation project in that region, because relating the importance of saving these species that couldn't be found anywhere else to the people, the local people, was a challenge, because a lot of the local people, only their only relationship to some of these species is sustenance. You know, we eat these species, and so now you're telling us that we shouldn't eat them because there's some value, you know, and trying to convey that idea to people who really never leave, you know, the locations mm-hmm. and the regions that they live in, is something that can be challenging. Because I think a lot of us in the West that have privilege, we see wildlife in terms of something exotic that's of value, as opposed to something that is integral to our survival.
And Roger also incorporates the stories of his father in this show too, if I'm correct. And his father has had a really fascinating life in the Congo.
Yeah, I'm hoping to have Roger on a show and talk more in depth from his own personal experience about his father's history. But I am excited to see there's a film he's working on that details how his father actually faked his death and wound up being a helicopter pilot for Mobutu in the Congo. For the CIA. So that's all pretty interesting stuff, like, you know, Hollywood movie.
Yeah, if you made a movie of it, people wouldn't believe that it wasn't fiction.
Exactly. So yeah, that'll be happening. That'll be opening on the first Thursday in November at PNCA in downtown Portland.
Well, it sounds like Roger Peet's going to be an artist to watch then.
Indeed, and he's part of the Just Seeds Collective, which does a lot of really cool visual art. Yeah, check him out.
Well, Mike, I'm thinking listeners might also be curious, what does one do to get ready for a trip to Africa?
There's a battery of shots. There's typhoid, malaria, yellow fever, one of the hepatitis. I forget which hepatitis vaccination you get. I know that for sure. And then there might be a couple of things I'm forgetting. Since I've been going every year since 2012 now, this will be my third trip since 2012. Some of the vaccinations that I got last a number of years, so I don't have to re-get them or get them again. And then, of course, there's like anti-diarrheal medications you might take, or salts to help your body rehydrate if you do get dehydrated from diarrhea and vomiting from some type of GI infection. I'm lucky. Luckily, I haven't been sick on my trips. I'm going to be very careful. People are real concerned right now about the Ebola crisis, right? And we know that the continent of Africa is extremely vast. I think it is the biggest continent. And when we think of West Africa, where the Ebola outbreak is concentrated right now, I'm actually going to be in the southern region. Okay, I'm going to be thousands of miles away from that. But if we have three cases in the United States and somebody can get on a plane and bring it anywhere in the world, what's to prevent, you know, me from being at risk? And so I have been reading a lot about, you know, how to treat surfaces and what to avoid. So
good luck with that.
Thanks. You guys will know if I come back. You know, it's funny to laugh about it because it's really not funny. It's a deadly, horrible disease. Yeah,
you have to keep a positive attitude about it. Otherwise, you would never leave your front door.
Well, there's a few weeks where the virus could be inside of you, and I would hope to not bring it back to KBOO and infect the mics.
Yes, we thank you for that. On a completely different topic, we have a couple minutes left. You know, we just came off of a really exciting and successful membership drive.
Right.
Maybe our listeners are interested in what they could do around the station besides contribute monetarily.
Uh-huh.
Can you give us some info on what people should do if they're interested in getting involved either in the news department or any other area of the station?
About every 4 weeks, we have volunteer orientation, and that's actually happening this Saturday at noon. So if you're in the area or you want to volunteer and become part of KABU and figure out what it takes to make the station run, come on down this Saturday at noon. Be part of the volunteer orientation, because that's actually the first step in being able to do other things like learning to operate the board. There's a board operator training on Friday the 17th from 4 to 6. There's a beginning digital editing training Monday the 20th from 5 to 7 p.m. And there's an intro to audio production, just to name a few. And that intro to audio production is Friday the 17th from 6 to 8. But like I said, the first step is volunteer orientation. So come on down this weekend.
And there are other opportunities available. I mean, we have people in the station who do janitorial work, who empty the garbages, who mm-hmm. man the front desk.
Right.
So even if you don't have a voice or an eye for radio, there's other stuff you can do, right?
Indeed. I mean, there are people who wash the dishes. Sometimes the staff does it. Sometimes volunteers do it. But thank you for that, Aaron, because it takes a lot to make KABU work.
Yeah, if you care about the station, come on down and see what can be done, because you don't have to worry about, we won't put the microphone in your face if you don't want it. There's lots of other stuff to be done.
Indeed.
All right, we're out of time. Thanks so much,
Mike. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Restoring Volcano Country, a fundraising event for the Gifford Pinchot Task Force on Thursday, October 16th at 5:30 p.m. The event includes live music, local artists, a live and silent auction, and more, and takes place at Holocene. The Gifford Pinchot Task Force mission is to protect and sustain the Gifford Pinchot National Forest and neighboring communities through conservation, science, and advocacy. Again, that's Restoring Volcano Country, a fundraising event for the Gifford Pinchot Task Force on Thursday, October 16th at 5:30 p.m. at Holocene, 1001 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Sun Lee, KABU's membership director. Thank you to everyone who called in during our fall membership drive. With your amazing support, we reached our $80,000 goal. We would also like to thank all of our volunteers for doing a great job and for making KABU a great community and radio station. And thank you to all of the restaurants that provided food. For more information on them, visit kboo.fm